Welcome to Polycast, a Civilization podcast focused on game strategy.
Dan Q.
Makalua.
The Vian Team.
QNL, with guest co-hosts.
Alpha Shard.
Hans Lemerson.
Ishmir Stinger.
Jet.
The Tower Turtle.
Basically, if you play Civilization, you are an egomaniac. I mean, it says right on the box, build a civilization to stand the test of time. And you're there like, oh yeah, I can do that. I can do that. No problem. So you are an egomaniac.
Hello, Civilization fans. This is Polycast episode 90. I'm guest host Jet, and I'm here with Dan Q.
Hello, everyone.
Hans Lemerson.
Greetings, gentlemen.
Ishmir Stinger.
Thank you for having me.
Metalli Turtle.
In the house.
And last but not least, Alpha Shard.
Hello.
There's an argument about everything in any Civ 5 forum. It's the nature of the beast.
That'd be a good episode title. Argument about everything.
No, it wouldn't.
No, that would be a horrible episode.
That would be a bad idea.
As our listeners can tell, I'm the only regular co-host here, so we already mentioned events. Trying to remember what annoys Lisa.
Bad grammar.
Bad grammar. Yeah, that's true. Yeah, so someone come up with a really bad grammatical sentence we can include there. I'll address the Mackie issue. Mackie's not here. Neither is Lisa or Phil.
All our base is ours. Wait, all your base belong to us.
All your base are belong to us.
Yes.
Wait, did I just correct your grammar on non-grammar?
Under the miscellaneous heading, getting the AI to play with itself.
Forum talk. What does it mean to be hardcore? And the rise of Facebook gaming.
In news, assorted Civilization 5 info from GDC 2010 and other places.
And recorded live at PAX 2010, Polycast correspondent Tim Steiner-Davian Seifert speaks with Civilization 5 designer Dennis Shirk from Firaxis Games. Then, clips from Sid Meier's keynote address at the Game Developers Conference 2010.
I think this would be the proper time to talk about getting the AIs to play with themselves.
Okay. Keeping in mind this is a family-friendly show, please go ahead and introduce the topic.
Okay. This topic is going to be how to get the AI players to play the game on their own. So you could basically start in on a game 20 turns in and just jump in where it is, or see what happens if AIs are left to their own devices.
One powerful method for doing that I'd like to suggest is you can find instructions for it by going to cscforums.civfanatics.com and searching for game.aiplay. But briefly, you put cheat code equals Chipotle in your any file, and that allows you, for one thing, to use Control-Z to reveal the map and to reveal AI cities. And then you go into the console with the backquote key and then type game.aiplay space and then some number of turns. What that will do is takes you out of the game, so you lose one civ, your civ drops out of the game, and then the AIs will just play that many turns, and you can, when they're done, you can watch and see what they did.
That's going to give an advantage to AIs that started near your starting location because they'll have more expansion room.
That's true, so it's kind of impossible to do without throwing off the game a little bit. You can start a game with one extra civilization, but it'll still throw off the distribution of civs around the map a little bit. Yeah, that's true.
Or you could do a custom map and just put yourself on a tiny little island.
Indeed. One other method for getting the AI to play with itself, it looks like the Better AI mod has its own version of an autoplay feature, the slightly different user interface.
Yeah, I think the way it's set up interface-wise is it will play out X number of turns before the game begins. So it doesn't drop out the human player. It puts you under AI control and then drops you in.
I think it saves it as a scenario so you can drop in as anybody you want to.
Ooh, even better.
I think it might actually be entertaining to watch the civilizations, how they play against themselves. I mean, it does happen where the civ will dogpile on another civ or, you know, just other things. So it'd be kind of like watching history unfold in a way.
So, Montezuma, what do you want to do tonight? The same thing we do every night, Shaka. Try to take over the world.
That was awesome.
This is Forum Talk, where we investigate hot civ issues in the forums.
I'd like to talk about what it means to be a hardcore player. I thought that was very interesting.
Mm.
Speaking of AIs playing with themselves.
Oh, God.
On the Flash of Steel strategy game blog, what is a hardcore gamer?
Me.
Were previous installments in the Civilization franchise just for hardcore gamers? And he disagreed as a what he considers himself a hardcore strategy gamer. He thinks that Civilization is somewhat softcore as far as strategy games go, having played games like Hearts of Iron or Panzer General, which is allegedly a inspiration for Civilization V.
To the extent that hexagons are.
I think that quote, it's not just for the hardcore anymore. I think that came from the preview of Civ 5 on GameSpy.
Yes.
The way the claim was substantiated in the preview is that the preview is structured into five features where the preview author claims all make it easier. Hexagons, supposedly making it easier to see possible paths that you can take around the map. The change from allowing units to be, multiple units to be stacked up on a tile to one unit per tile. Easier modding. And the return of advisors to the game, and then something else about cities.
That doesn't really sound like hardcore stuff. Hexagons are not actually easier for newcomers because people are accustomed to grids.
Yeah, I don't buy that either.
And I don't think any of that gets to the heart of why people do call Civilization hardcore.
Yeah.
I think the real reason they're doing that is because it takes 20, 30 hours to play a game if you're not the me and Dean. And none of those say anything about, well, the game doesn't take as long to play anymore. I mean, that's what Civilization Revolution was, really.
I think that's part of the thing, you know, is not just the length, but the why it takes so long is because there's so much depth. There's so much calculating. I don't even do half the calculating some of these people do on Civ Fanatics. Is it financially viable to build a space elevator or not, or to put this workshop there? And it can get really, really in-depth, all the way back from the first game, I think. And so I think Civilization has always been hardcore, not because of what grids it uses, but because of just how much detail it has.
Absolutely, yeah, it is very complex. And not all of it is even that well explained, although in Civ 4 I thought tutorial was very good, and the SIDS tips and the various pop-ups were all very good. Some of the basic mechanics, it took me quite a while. I had not played Civ before Civ 4.
Ooh.
So some of the basic mechanics about like tile yields, for example, which I think the game developers tended to sort of assume that people would understand off the bat, just because everyone who developed the game had probably been playing since Civ 2 or something. I found were not very well explained, at least not for me. But on the whole, compared to some other, like, extremely nerdy games, personally, I think the Civilization UI is quite good, and it's about as friendly as it can be for the level of complexity it has.
Yeah, well, UIs can always be improved, but yeah, it's not bad.
I'm sure if Phil were here, he'd be disagreeing.
On this Flash of Steel blog, which is by Troy Goodfellow, a gaming journalist who has appeared on Polycast before,
Ooh. He
said in part that from where I sit, hardcore is an adjective best applied to players, not games, quote-unquote. And I'm going to agree with Troy, which sounds like I'm disagreeing with some or all here on the panel, but that makes for an interesting discussion now, doesn't it?
Well, it's all about how much of yourself you want to put into the game.
You can streamline it by hitting automate and just letting your governors click the little tiles that are going to be worked and what building should be built, and you're just like basically pressing enter until the end of the game. You can make it very streamlined.
Yeah, build three settlers and then build every wonder.
All right, but what's the maximum difficulty you could actually win doing that on? I think there's a minimum amount you have to put into this game, and it's much higher than the minimum required by other games. That's why I think that hardcore game is applicable to Civilization IV.
Yeah.
The term certainly makes sense for both players and games, in slightly different ways.
I think it may also be just how much investment you need to make in the game in order to achieve a certain level of skill.
Yes, and for me that's why if you're a hardcore player, then you're more likely going to be able to go up the difficulty levels and not just survive, but even thrive. And so because of that, scalability for Civ 4 and really for any game. I still think that when we talk about hardcore, we want to talk about the players, not the game itself, because between that and the automation, yes, you can get into people, like you were saying, Scott, figuring out the formulas and looking at the code to save a turn or two here or there. I mean, now that is hardcore. I mean, and everything is relative, and if you're talking about those kind of people, then I'm not hardcore, but I am hardcore compared to someone who just picks up Civ 4 every now and again, because I do play the game every week. If we look at, for instance, I think a lot of the times is, what does it mean to be hardcore? And if we're talking about a definition, I think the dictionary definition fits very well. Hardcore, unswervingly committed, uncompromising, dedicated, diehard, the most dedicated, unfailingly loyal faction of a group or organization. We're talking about people, we're talking about gamers in this situation, we're not talking about the game itself.
Well, I mean, I think the way language works is that terms that are applied to one concept tend to bleed out into related concepts, just because of the connotation.
Yeah.
And it may have a slightly different shade of meaning when applied to related concepts.
Like porn.
Perhaps. Let's suppose etymologically that term hardcore originally referred to people. Yeah, it could be various activities or spheres in which people engage in hardcore behavior. The other kinds of entities in those spheres, like games or whatever, might then start to themselves be called hardcore just because of the association with hardcore people. And so I just think that's the way language naturally works, is that terms sort of drift around like that to associated concepts. And so it's both.
I'm pretty sure it did originally refer to people. If you look at the way it's used in movies made in the early 80s, late 70s, they're referring to badasses, to people who do very dangerous or crazy things.
That's badass, man.
That guy's hardcore.
Huh.
I think basically what they're trying to do is keep the game from being too simple, like Civ Rev, and still detailed, but having the options for casual players who don't want to get too involved and be able to get off the game and have a life.
Oh, for sure. Undoubtedly, that's the goal with all versions of Civ.
Yes.
As to what Civ 5 has for us in terms of different levels of complexity, I think nobody knows yet.
I'm not even going to get into, but the Civ Rev and the simple portion, that's a totally separate conversation.
I'm wondering about what the complexity level in Facebook Civ is going to be like.
The Rise of Facebook Gaming, which is an article on GamePro's website by Julian Murdoch, who is a regular on the Three Moves Ahead podcast, which Troy Goodfellow is also on, and Julian Murdoch is also another gaming industry journalist. And this one is looking at the rise of Facebook gaming, not just Civilization Network, but other games like from Brian Reynolds and the Zynga company, the Farmville.
Oh, I hate Farmville.
And they quote Gareth Davison, program manager for games, which is, Facebook has become the crucible of the new game industry, and we're just at the beginning of this new form of game design. Okay, you're full of it, but I also understand, Gareth, that that is your job, to be full of it. So, you know, I take that with sort of a grain of salt, where that source is coming from.
I really don't like a lot of the games on the Facebook, because it's all a bunch of just clicking a button. You don't actually do anything. I actually did a vampire app, and you tell your vampire to go attack some goons, and you're not actually doing that. You're just clicking attack goons,
well,
and it's just so boring.
Yes,
the Dungeons & Dragons one is self-parodying. You literally say, go on an adventure, and then for the next hour or so, all it does is report on what your adventures are. There's no interaction beyond that.
Wow.
And some of the adventures make fun of other games on Facebook, like Farmville. In one of your adventures, you rescue, like, a lost kitten on a farm.
Oh, dear. But I think those kind of little games there can get some of that kind of simplicity stuff off of Facebook as well. So I think, honestly, even though I'm not a fan of Facebook, period, let alone Facebook games, I think it's just another means to hook people into the Civilization franchise, just like there's Civilization Revolution for people who prefer to game on the console platform. You can't deny the number of people that are playing Facebook games, yeah, or the number of users that Facebook has. So the market is there. There's the potential there. So,
yeah.
But Davis is kind of implying that this is the new game industry, and so now PC and console is like,
well,
it's old games.
Yeah. Nobody can really predict this stuff, but Facebook is popular, and yeah, absolutely, if it gets more people to play Civ, that's great for everybody, right? And we don't know that Civilization Networks is going to suck. I mean, Sid's working on it. I think it'll be as good as it can be. I think Civ is actually is probably a really good fit to it because it's turn-based, so you can pop in and out of it. And the different ways of playing multiplayer Civ, either real-time multiplayer or succession games or other kinds of things like that, personally I found those to be really fun. And the social dimension of being able to play Civ with other people adds quite a lot to it. So I'm hopeful.
Yeah, I think one of the big sort of issues where you can get into a lot of argument, basically a difference in terms. The Facebook games are really very, very, very different from the games that people who like to play Civ like to play. Some of them, as we've pointed out, can you even call them games?
That's what I'm saying.
I think you can.
Well, you can't win them, so that's one of the major criteria, I think, for games.
If it's just a bunch of click a button and your character does this, it's just, where's the fun?
What's the goal?
Yeah, it'd be like playing a race car game and you press a button and your car races. Or you play a fighting game and you press a button and your guy fights. There's no involvement.
It's still a game, it's just what kind of game is it? And
it's a lot like letting the AI play with itself.
It can be, yeah.
Someone commented about Civ is turn-based, so it could work well in a situation like that. But could there be a Facebook RTS game? Facebook StarCraft.
Facecraft.
I wouldn't rule it out. Facebook gaming is just getting off the ground here. And in part in that article, Sid talked about trying to introduce a game to the Facebook gaming market that doesn't exist right now. When Civilization Revolution came out on the console, there really was not a strategy game like Civ. So it's trying to tap into, okay, people are playing what games are available, but certainly in that huge mass of console gamers and now the huge mass of Facebook gamers, there are people certainly that are looking for something that are more involved, but they prefer the convenience, the platform, combination thereof of Facebook as opposed to a PC or a console. PC, console, and the Facebook, they can all coexist. There'll be some people that like to play in just one sphere. Maybe some people like to be in two. Some like to all be in three. It's just, I think the thing that I get kind of annoyed with is comments like Davis, like, this is the new, so PC and inherently console then is old, and so then they're going by the wayside. I mean,
yeah, I agree with you, Dan.
We will not go quietly into the night.
It is good that they're expanding Civ into multiple formats and platforms to get more attention and more money, and I mean, that means they get to make more games, and that's always a good thing. It's just I don't want them to ever exclude one. That's kind of what happened with adventure games. It got kind of stomped down by first-person shooters and most people wanting to play just action games, and so I don't want that to happen with games like Civ.
I think this is another attempt of Sid Meier to innovate, and in this case his reach may be exceeding his grasp, like with that Sid Meier's Dinosaurs project that never got off the ground.
Well, he did acknowledge in his keynote at the Game Developer Conference, quote-unquote, my bad.
Dun, dun, dun.
Here's what's been making news in the Civ community.
What we know is new with Civilization V, at least if plethora of previews that are coming out are to be believed.
You can never draw any conclusions from something that isn't in a screenshot. I see a lot of people doing that. They see a screenshot and, oh no, there's no Fog of War in the screenshot.
Yeah.
You can't conclude that the Fog of War concept is gone because you don't see what you recognize as Fog of War. That's a logical fallacy, and people are making it left and right.
So what you're saying is the plethora of previews is probably pretty pernicious?
Oh.
I can pontificate on that point if it pleases you.
I love alliteration. This is great.
Going for the highbrow.
Alliteration is fun.
Whoa. Wait a minute. Wait a minute. Alliteration is not fun. Alliteration is awesome.
Yes.
Absolutely.
All right.
Pontification of pretty pernicious points.
Or maybe pontification on pretty pointless points.
One thing, apparently, according to the preview in PC Power Play, an Australian transport troops are gone. Instead, units instantly transferred into makeshift floating transports in a similar way to Empire Earth, quote-unquote, and I think of Rise of Nations actually did that.
I could have sworn I read an interview with Soren. He or some other designer talked about that feature in some game, and whoever the interviewee was said it sucked because it made water not really an obstacle if you just turn into a transport and effectively walk across it.
It's still an obstacle if you're defenseless while you're in that transport mode.
Yeah, fair enough.
You know, you step off the coast and all of a sudden you're a boat. You don't have magical ability to walk across water because there's submarines in the water.
Personally, I do not find it fun to load troops onto transports. It's a chore.
And the AI is not good at that.
Building the transports for an intercontinental invasion is busy work.
Yeah, it's kind of good that it's a challenge you have to overcome, but the way it's done, it does leave something to be desired.
Now, something like you give your unit an order for basically board a transport, and then like it sits there next turn, it'll appear as a boat. That's a system that a game I worked on where we wanted to get rid of transports. It was a turn-based strategy game, kind of like Advance Wars, but transports were annoying on Advance Wars. And so you walk your unit over to a beach, then you give it the order, load into a transport, ends its turn. Next turn, it begins it on a transport, but it's completely defenseless. And yeah, you have to escort it across, and then you land it on the beach, and it unloads, but that's the end of its turn. And so it's vulnerable to being attacked. Yes, you can technically take your army and walk over the water, wherever, but you're vulnerable. And if you don't have a beachhead, there's nothing you can do. It really depends on how it's implemented.
Yeah.
It could potentially be really exciting because even in Civ 4, we have the concept of you're vulnerable when you unload onto a beachhead because that takes your movement and you can be counterattacked. But now that there's one unit per tile, you could have long beachheads.
Oh, yeah.
Talking D-Day, Normandy invasion type stuff, where you have to continually unload single units onto the beach and then have many of them destroyed by the defenders and repeat that process. I think it could potentially be very exciting.
Sounds like it might be difficult, actually.
One thing I wondered about with the one unit per tile and having fewer units and units being more valuable, are they going to keep the combat mechanic of basically battle to the death? Every time units fight, one of them will die?
Supposedly not. Supposedly units run away.
Okay, that's good. That was always a slight annoyance in Civ, because, okay, your unit is way stronger than theirs, you have a 90% chance of winning. So there's a 10% chance you might just die and you're gone.
I played a war game called Diplomacy, ironically enough,
Yay.
Where the only way to destroy units was to force them to retreat in a situation where there was literally no place to which they could retreat. Otherwise, units always survived combat.
Yeah, same in Hearts of Iron.
We know that religion has been removed.
That sucks.
From Civilization V. Balancing issues, and the reason identified by John Schaefer, designer himself, was that religion was so much for the basis for whether or not a Civ liked you or not, so they decided to just leave religion behind. I knew that, but apparently something else has been removed. According to IGN, in addition to religion is gone, so is espionage.
They better put that back in an expansion pack like they did with...
I can live with the religion, but I hope espionage... Oh, no.
Well...
IGN say it isn't so.
Well, but for espionage, isn't it traditional that diplomacy was the precursor to espionage? Civ 2, diplomats, you send them over, and you pay 500 gold, and you take the enemy city.
Yeah, I love that.
Yeah.
Not going to get that back, though, I know. Oh, that was so much fun. Those were the days. I'll just buy my empire, just send out diplomats, that's how I did war. Send out my diplomats, buy my cities.
Well, there was a recent preview where it talked about the elimination of road spam, which is kind of comparable perhaps in a way to what's going on in Civilization Revolution, where the roads that are built are between cities, and that's it. Now, that's, of course, more abstracted than it would be in Civ 5, but I talked before how Civilization 4, we got rid of infinite city sprawl, that Civilization 5 seems poised to get rid of the Stack of Doom issue, and so now some people seem to be equating road spam to be up there, but meh. The idea the Civ creators at Civ Studio Firaxis are looking for is, they said, that, quote, roads will mean something, unquote, this time.
Ah.
Whoa. Did you hear that, roads? From Civ 1 to Civ 4, Firaxis is talking smack about you.
I thought roads always meant something. Meant faster movement.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So will they be built automatically, or will you only be able to build them on certain squares, or will you invest road production on squares or something? Or
yeah, we'll see. Maybe they'll be more expensive.
You're definitely going to be able to build them. That was a big activity of the Roman Empire. You know how much these guys love Rome.
Yes.
Yes. So here we are at PAX East. I'm standing here with Dennis Shirk, the producer with 4Axis, talking about Civ 5. How are you doing today?
I'm doing great. Great show so far.
So what can you tell us about Civ 5? The community is really anxious to see this game come out. It kind of caught me by surprise with the announcement a couple weeks ago. And talked about it on Polycast, and they asked me to come on over here and see what you guys can tell us.
We've somehow managed to keep this secret for the last 2.5 years of development. And we're just really excited to be able to finally talk about it now. I mean, we're going to be shipping this fall. There's still a lot more to reveal. Obviously, we're only reeling a little bit at a time to keep everybody on pins and needles. Yeah, we're hoping that everybody's loving what we're doing, so we're really excited about it.
Judging from the lines I've seen here yesterday and today, you know, as soon as the doors open, you already got people lined up trying to fill up the last few seats for the demo. That's pretty impressive.
We're completely geeking out about that. I mean, just the fact that people are waiting in line to see something that we've made is just an excellent thrill, especially since it's like fan through the show and not just, you know, press. It's just amazing.
Yeah, it's definitely incredible. I personally have been playing Civ for the last 20 years now since it first came out, so I'm really looking forward to seeing what you guys got in store. So the community provided me a list of questions, and we're just going to go down that list and see what you can tell us.
Okay.
Is it true that we're going to be allowed to have one unit per tile, and how is that going to work? No more Stacks of Doom, I guess?
Yeah, Stacks of Doom are no longer in the game. What we really were trying to do with one military unit per tile is to pull combat like out of the cities. We want people to take advantage of the terrain and take away advantages that really large civs might have over small civs. So small civs can, for instance, defend a mountain pass with very few units against any number of invading forces because they can only bring one unit into the bear. You can defend your hills well. You can use your, for instance, rangers like archers in defensive positions just because it allows defense to be much more stout if you're taking advantage of the terrain outside of the cities. And that's the main thing that we wanted to do. We wanted to make that whole tactical game much more interesting. You have to put some thought into it, but it's going to make for a more exciting game, we think.
I absolutely can agree with that. There's one thing I kind of didn't like about the earlier iterations is that it's just really just a stack of doom. Whoever's got more units in one place is going to win.
Yeah, I mean, that's certainly going to be said about it. Obviously, the stack of doom is something that's everybody's used to playing, and it's a part of Civ. It's embedded into the Civ franchise as a whole. So making the switch is a big deal, and we know that it comes across as a shock to some people that are just really used to playing Civilization. But once you see it, and once you try it, and you see how it really just blows out the tactical game, we think people are going to really love what it does.
Excellent. We're looking forward to it. So how much can you tell us about resources? Is it correct that luxury resources and food resources will be infinite, but strategic resources like oil and iron may be a bit more limited?
Yes, that's currently how it is. You never know how things are going to end up. Main word, iterative design studio, so John might be making changes right up until the Gold Masters hand it off. But right now, we want strategic resources to be very important. So if you have an iron resource that yields, for instance, 3 iron, that means you're going to be able to maintain 3 swords and then no more. If one of the swordsmen dies, then you can build one more. But units are much more important now. We don't want to have, like, just units span everywhere. They're going to be more expensive to maintain. They're going to be more expensive to build. So we want everything to be important. So we wanted to have finite strategic resources in the game.
I believe on an early episode of Polycast, someone had posted on one of the forums and they were talking about strategic resources being limited for the number of units and whatnot, resources running out, stuff like oil and iron when the mines run dry or the wells run dry.
Yeah, that's absolutely correct. And the cool thing is with stuff like that, John Schaefer, a lead designer, actually comes from the fan community, so this is one gift wrap package to fans. And we hope that a lot of stuff that's always talked about in the fan community actually makes it in the game. And this is probably one of those.
Excellent. Thanks. So how are the graphics going to change, if any? We saw in the initial screenshots, is that pretty much what we could expect for the final screen to look like?
We're pre-alpha. It's only going to go up from here. Pre-alpha, usually the graphics that are in, sometimes they're placeholders, sometimes they're early versions of the graphics. And you head into alpha, and it's all about polish from there on out. So you're going to be seeing some amazing things. Even the demo that we showed at GDC was probably about a month and a half old, and the demo that we're showing here is just leaps and bounds even above what people saw at GDC in that last round of screenshots. So I think people are going to be really impressed.
So what can you tell us about ranged combat? We saw a little bit of that going on in the screenshots. Is it true that an archer can be able to shoot across, like, the English Channel?
Across the English Channel, if we happen to have a one-tile square of water, they would shoot across it. And I think what's most important for people to remember is that combat, just like it always has been in the past, is an abstraction of what's going on. And Praxis will always choose gameplay over realism. What we really wanted to just do is do do something different with ranged units. We wanted them to be weaker in melee, but strong as the support units. So you can have them behind your melee units. You can have them as strong defensive units. We just really wanted to bring something different to the game, to the tactical game. Especially since we were doing one unit per tile, this really made sense, and it makes for an extremely fun bit of gameplay. One of our testers up at 2K was just talking to us last night about how he's normally a builder, he's normally that kind of player, but the changes that we've made into the tactical game have just made him love that aspect of the game. Before, it was just kind of a side note to him, but now he's just buried in it. He loves what we're doing.
Are we going to be able to have more than a range of one, more modern ranged units, like artillery and stuff like that?
Yes, that is some stuff that you're going to see. As we talk about the modern game more, you're going to see some more details on that, especially things like the battleship, things like that.
Okay. So how's intercontinental invasions going to work with the troops and transports?
This is something that in past versions of Civ, I mean, everybody's familiar with loading a transport up, sending it across the water, that kind of thing. We wanted to facilitate intercontinental invasions a little bit better, really kind of highlight the naval game a little bit more than it's been before, especially with one unit per tile. And what we've added is the ability for units, after you've researched the appropriate tech, to be able to embark themselves. They take a turn, they prepare themselves for water, and they can embark from your coastline and basically go across the water. When they're in this form, they're counted as civilian units. I mean, they're defenseless. If you have them out there alone, an enemy civ or a barbarian boat, for that matter, can just basically sink those boats one at a time. So you have to protect them. You have to build naval units to protect these embarked units. But hopefully, taking the extra step out of having to manage your transport and the micromanagement of getting your guys on the transport will really facilitate intercontinental battles a lot more readily. That's something that we think is going to be really cool to people who play the game a lot.
So how is the transport defense going to work with the one unit per tile rule?
When they become transports, when you embark your unit, they become basically civilian boats. And civilian boats exist on their own layer besides military units. So you can group that with a large ship. If you have a battleship out there, a destroyer, a galleon, you're going to be able to group that with that and sail them across as defense. You don't have to have a group, but you can, and it's advisable. Just like if you have a settler roaming out to the countryside, you want a military unit with it to protect it. And so civilians exist on their own layer, so they'll be able to basically walk right along with your military units.
So we have like almost an infinite number of civilian units with one military unit on a tile, or is there some kind of limit imposed in there as well?
Civilian units still have to follow the same rule, just on their own layer. One civilian unit per tile, one military unit per tile, one air unit per tile. So you've got your layers there. You can stack infinite civilian units, but you can have four civilian units side by side and garrison them with a couple boats that can shift around. So there's options there, but you still have to take that kind of space into account.
Okay, so it sounds like it kind of worked like the historical convoy system where, like, there's a bunch of ships out there and there's very limited military vessels to protect them. But they kind of, like, go back and forth in a random pattern just to throw everybody off and kind of cover everybody at the same time.
Correct. What we're really hoping to do is make a much more dynamic naval game than we've had before, and I think this really is pulling it off so far.
I think it sounds like that. The naval game always seemed a bit kind of weak in the earlier iterations of Civ.
Yeah.
So this sounds like a really exciting change there. Are there going to be games to speed similar like Marathon or Quick coming up to Civ 5?
Yeah, most of those options are going to feel very familiar to people that play Civilization 4. The map sizes are very familiar. You know, playing a Quick game, playing a Marathon game, all those options are going to be in there and feel very familiar to people who've played before.
Is the gameplay in general going to be a lot faster, even at all levels, compared to previous versions of Civ with only one unit per town? I'd imagine that would require less units overall.
No, the gameplay's not going to be faster. I mean, obviously, you are going to have less units overall. Like I mentioned before, they're more expensive. The maintenance on them is a little bit more expensive. You're maintaining smaller armies, but you're covering a larger area. The gameplay speed is not going to be affected by that. Units last longer. There's not sudden death as a result of the battle. So you can actually pull wounded units back to heal, move stronger units up. You may not have a huge stack, and it's not going to take longer because you're not just wiping through an entire stack. You're still wounding units, so the game speed is still going to be relative to everything else you're doing.
Okay, cool. So how's it going to work if we have an allied civ or a friendly civ and they want to move into the same tile as one of my units?
Currently, most base units in the game have a base move of 2, and we wanted to do that just because we didn't want to have these log jams happen. If it's a hostile civ or a neutral civ, you're not going to be able to move from them. They're going to be able to block you. If they're like maintaining a mountain pass and standing there, you're not going to be able to go through them unless you kill them. If it's obviously one of your units, that kind of thing, you can use that movement notifier and either switch places with them, you can move through them if you have the movement available, but there is going to be situations where you have an occupying unit on a space that sucks up movement points, like up on a hill, where you're not going to be able to go through them. You're going to have to find your way around them, or you're going to have to kill them or ask them to move.
What about corporations and religion? What can you tell us about that? I saw something that religion, as we knew it in Civ 4, was removed. Is that going to be represented in another fashion? And what about corporations?
Religion in Civilization 4 has been removed. I mean, John's never going to take something out of the game and leave Smoldering Hole in its place. He's always going to have something that kind of takes the place of that. Everything that John is doing with diplomacy, the religion system as it existed in Civilization 4 just didn't work. It didn't make sense, especially with that whole city-state layer that's going into place. There are some larger features that we cannot talk about yet that people are going to see is really fills the gap nicely. Corporations are something that was added in Beyond the Sword. That's not currently in place in Civilization 5. And I'm sure there's going to be a lot of other cool things you're going to be reading about in the coming months. That it's not so much a distraction, but it's going to make you very happy with what's coming in.
All right. What about spherical maps? They were kind of implemented, I know, in Civ 3 a little bit with X and Y axes. Are we going to be able to see that here in Civ 5?
We decided not to go the route of spherical map. We are putting something in that we're not talking about yet. I mean, there's been a lot of chatter about the mystery strategic view button at the bottom of the screen from people who've seen screenshots or attended our demos, but that's something we'll be talking about more coming in the future.
Okay. What about espionage? In Civ 4, it was kind of left out until, I guess, it was Beyond the Sword. Is that going to be included here from the start in Civ 5?
No, the espionage system as it was in Civ 4 is also something that is not going to make an appearance in the middle of Civ 5. That's not to say it won't eventually show up, but that system alone, again, it didn't make sense with what John is doing with the new features he's adding in, especially for modern-day gameplay. And, again, that's something, I hate saying it, but that's something we'll be talking about in the coming months.
That's totally understandable. Thanks for all your time. I really appreciate answering all these questions. And I would be remiss as representing Polycast here if I didn't ask you Dan's favorite question.
Yep.
Would you be on Polycast again in the future?
You can tell Dan that we will always be on Polycast again in the future. So we've done so many Polycasts in the past, and that's never an issue for us.
Thank you very much. I really appreciate your time.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So the first area where psychology really kind of plays an important role in game design is something I call the winner paradox. In real life, you don't always win. There are, 28 teams in the National Football League, and only one of them gets to win the Super Bowl. There are 25 teams in the NBA. They all go to the playoffs, I guess, but at the end of the day, there's only one team that gets to hold the golden trophy of NBA championness or whatever that is. However, in the world of games, you pretty much always win. And the psychological phenomenon is that the player doesn't really complain about that, doesn't object. That's not a problem. I don't get letters saying, you know, dear Sid, I loved your game, but I won way too much. I think this is kind of fundamental to entertainment. It's certainly something that we're aware of in designing video games, that the player is looking for a satisfactory conclusion. That might not always include winning, but very often it does. And this idea of kind of a satisfactory conclusion to the game, I think, is something to really keep in mind in the design process. Some of the tools that we have at our disposal to create this journey for the player through the game, reward and punishment. In other words, you know, good things happening to the player, not so good things happening to the player. There's an interesting dichotomy in how these are deployed in games. When you reward the player gladly accepts that, doesn't question, you know, did I really earn that? Do I deserve that? Players are very much inclined to accept anything you give them gladly and feel it was their own clever play, their own incredible strategy that earned them that cool reward. On the other hand, if something bad happens to the player, your game is broken, there's something horribly wrong, your game is cheating, it's really important to be very careful with the setbacks that the player experiences in the game. It's important that the player understand why those things happened, and especially how to prevent that from happening the next time. And anytime you can kind of plant that seed of the next time in the player's head, you're well on your way to this idea of replayability, that the player's going to play again. Next time I'm going to try something different, maybe that might not happen. So a big part of the value of these games is in their replayability. In terms of rewards, another key thing that we think about is the first 15 minutes. One of our rules of game design is that the first 15 minutes have to be really compelling, really fun, kind of almost a foreshadowing of all the cool stuff that's going to happen later in the game. And these rewards are really a way of making the player feel comfortable in this world. Civilization IV has 9 difficulty levels, and it really points out how this idea of progress and advancement is so rewarding for the player. The reason we have these difficulty levels is to give the player this feeling that there's always another challenge out there, that they've mastered this level, they're ready to move on to the next level. Again, if you kind of follow the first 15-minute rule, it's very important that you kind of start the player off with a very positive experience.
Calling today. In North America, the number is 301-637-7659.
That's 301-637-POLY.
In Europe, 44-121-288-7659. That's 44-121-288-POLY.
You can Skype us at the Polycast or email us at thepolycast@gmail.com.
The only thing worse than being talked about is not being talked about.
For more information on Polycast,
our sibling shows Modcast and Revcast,
or about Polycast in general,
log on to the series' official website at thepolycast.net. I'll list them just in the order that they have. I don't trust my ability to alphabetize on the fly here. America, Germany, Aztec, Inca, Japan, China, Arabia, Mongolia,
you have to do it to a tune.
France.
The Mexican hat dance, yeah.
All right, so someone do the music in the background. I'll start the list again. America, Germany, Aztec, Inca, Japan, China, Arabia, Mongolia, Rome, France, India, England, Russia, Ottomans, Egypt, and Greece. I don't know how the song really goes.
America, Germany, Aztec, and Inca, and Japan, China, Arabia, Mongolia, Rome, France, India, England, song. What the? I've never heard of that. What is that?
Songhai?
Yeah,
Songhai?
I just skipped that one. Ignore it.
Okay. America, Germany, Aztec and Inca, Japan, China, Arabia, Mongolia, Rome, France, India, England, Russia, the Ottomans, Egypt and Greece. That's the end of the list.
Wonders. Now we need a Wonders song.
Well, but
okay.
Make sure before you try to sing it that you arrange them in order so that they'll fit in the meter.
Yeah, that was a problem.
Yes.
Yeah, that was a problem.
So I'd go for the Can-Can, or the Modern Major General song.
I am the very model of a Modern Major General.
I am the very model of a Modern Major General. I knew the words.
I am the very model of a Modern Major General. I have information, vegetable, animal, and mineral. I know the kings of England, and I quote spice historical from Marathon to Waterloo in order categorical. About binomial theorem, I am teeming with a lot of news. With many cheerful facts about the square of the hypotenuse.
With many cheerful facts about the square of the hypotenuse. With many cheerful facts about the square of the hypotenuse. With many cheerful facts about the square of the hypotenuse.
I didn't know I was going to have a chorus.
So, the Polycast musical tour, canceled before it was ever announced.
Oh my god.
Colossus and the Oracle, the Hanging Gardens Pyramids, Hagia Sophia, the Shakespeare's Amphitheater, that's not going to work.
This is so depressing, I cannot begin to tell you.
This has been Polycast number 90. I am your first-time co-host, Hans Lemerson. And we have Metalliturtle.
I'm Metalliturtle, and my fuzzy purple hat with the big white feather says that I am a hardcore player.
Alpha Shard.
You have no idea what you guys missed.
Jet.
Thanks for listening, folks.
Izzy.
Everything's better with giant fighting robots.
And Daniel Quick.
This is what you get when I'm the only regular co-host on the show.
Oh, no!
When you say something, you see blue squigglies?
I do.
Blue squigglies.
Blue squigglies confirmed.
We have blue squigglies.
Roger that, Houston. Blue squigglies are a go. All right.
We're not bad at math. I think all 10 of us agree here.
We may be thinking about the concept within the framework of previous Civ games, and it might not be that way anymore. We may be making false assumptions about it.
But making false assumptions is the entire purpose of this.
Oh, absolutely.
And when this is released later, after everybody knows that what we said was wrong, it'll be even better.
Civ producer noted that all Civ games eventually come out on the Mac.
Eventually. Eventually being the key word.
Oh, now you're trying to find ground upon which we can all agree. No, I
no, I'm not.
See what he did there?
No, actually, what did he do?
This has been Polycast number 90. I am your first-time co-host, Hans Lemerson. And we have some other guys.
I'm Jet. Thanks for listening.
Oh. Oh, yeah, thanks for listening. Fair enough. Yeah, maybe someone who actually knows what they're talking about should do it.
Record date?
March 13th, 2010. Everything You Know Is Wrong, a GDC 2010 keynote by Sid Meierclips, courtesy GameSpot.
Civilization sound clips, copyright Take Two Interactive.
Copyright Civilized Communication at civcom.net.